An awakening of male sexual desire by a new partner is known as the Coolidge effect, after a famous anecdote. One day, President Calvin Coolidge and his wife were visiting a government farm and were taken on separate tours. When Mrs. Coolidge was shown the chicken pens, she asked whether the rooster copulated more than once a day. "Dozens of times," replied the guide. "Please tell that to the president," Mrs. Coolidge requested. When the president was shown the pens and told about the rooster, he asked, "Same hen every time?" "Oh, no, Mr. President, a different one each time." The president said, "Tell that to Mrs. Coolidge." Many male mammals are indefatigable when a new willing female is available after each copulation. They cannot be fooled by the experimenter cloaking a previous partner or masking her scent. This shows, incidentally, that male sexual desire is not exactly undiscriminating. Males may not care what kind of female they mate with, but they are hypersensitive to which female they mate with. Men do not have the sexual stamina of roosters, but they show a kind of Coolidge effect in their desire over longer periods. In many cultures, including our own, men report that their sexual ardor for their wives wanes in the first years of marriage. It is the concept of the individual person, not her appearance or other qualities, that triggers the decline. The taste for new partners is not just an example of variety being the spice of life, as in getting bored with strawberry and wanting to try chocolate ripple. In Isaac Bashevis Singer's story Shlemiel the First, a simpleton from the mythical village of Chelm sets out on a trip but loses his way and inadvertently returns home, thinking he has come across another village, which by an amazing coincidence looks just like his. He meets a woman who looks exactly like the wife he has grown tired of and finds her ravishing. The meaning of life. Man does not live by bread alone, or by know-how, safety, children, or sex. People everywhere spend as much time as they can afford on activities that, in the struggle to survive and reproduce, seem pointless. In all cultures, people tell stories and recite poetry. They joke, laugh, and tease. They sing and dance. They decorate surfaces. They perform rituals. They wonder about the causes of fortune and misfortune, and hold beliefs about the supernatural that contradict everything else they know about the world. They concoct theories of the universe and their place within it. As if that weren't enough of a puzzle, the more biologically frivolous and vain the activity, the more people exalt it. Art, literature, music, wit, religion, and philosophy are thought to be not just pleasurable, but noble. They are the mind's best work, what makes life worth living. Why do we pursue the trivial and futile and experience them as sublime? To many educated people, the question seems horribly philistine, even immoral, but it is unavoidable for anyone interested in the biological makeup of Homo sapiens. Members of our species do mad deeds like taking vows of celibacy, living for their music, selling their blood to buy movie tickets, and going to graduate school. Why? How might we understand the psychology of the arts, humor, religion, and philosophy within the theme of this book, that the mind is a naturally selected neural computer? Every college has a faculty of arts, which usually dominates the institution in numbers and in the public eye. But the tens of thousands of scholars and millions of pages of scholarship have shed almost no light on the question of why people pursue the arts at all. The function of the arts is almost defiantly obscure, and I think there are several reasons why. One is that the arts engage not only the psychology of aesthetics, but the psychology of status. The very uselessness of art that makes it so incomprehensible to evolutionary biology makes it all too comprehensible to economics and social psychology. What better proof that you have money to spare than your being able to spend it on doodads and stunts that don't fill the belly or keep the rain out, but that require precious materials, years of practice, a command of obscure texts, or intimacy with the elite? Thorsten Veblen's and Quentin Bell's analyses of taste and fashion, in which an elite's conspicuous displays of consumption, leisure, and outrage are emulated by the rabble, sending the elite off in search of new, inimitable displays, nicely explains the otherwise inexplicable oddities of the arts. The grand styles of one century become tacky in the next, as we see in words that are both period labels and terms of abuse: Gothic, Mannerist, Baroque, Rococo. The steadfast patrons of the arts are the aristocracy and those who want to join them. Most people would lose their taste for a musical recording if they learned it was being sold at supermarket checkout counters or on late-night television, and even the work of relatively prestigious artists, such as Pierre-Auguste Renoir, draws derisive reviews when it is shown in a popular blockbuster museum show. The value of art is largely unrelated to aesthetics. A priceless masterpiece becomes worthless if it is found to be a forgery. Soup cans and comic strips become high art when the art world says they are, and then command conspicuously wasteful prices. Modern and postmodern works are intended not to give pleasure, but to confirm or confound the theories of a guild of critics and analysts, to épater la bourgeoisie, or to baffle the rubes in Peoria. The banality that the psychology of the arts is partly the psychology of status has been repeatedly pointed out, not just by cynics and barbarians, but by erudite social commentators such as Quentin Bell and Tom Wolfe. But in the modern university, it is unmentioned, indeed unmentionable. Academics and intellectuals are culture vultures. In a gathering of today's elite, it is perfectly acceptable to laugh that you barely passed physics for poets and rocks for jocks, and have remained ignorant of science ever since, despite the obvious importance of scientific literacy to informed choices about personal health and public policy. But saying that you have never heard of James Joyce or that you tried listening to Mozart once but prefer Andrew Lloyd Webber is as shocking as blowing your nose on your sleeve or announcing that you employ children in your sweatshop, despite the obvious unimportance of your tastes in leisure time activity to just about anything. The blending in people's minds of art, status, and virtue is an extension of Bell's principle of sartorial morality. People find dignity in the signs of an honorably futile existence removed from all menial necessities. I mention these facts not to denigrate the arts, but to clarify my topic. I want you to look at the psychology of the arts, and later humor and religion, with the disinterested eye of an alien biologist trying to make sense of the human species rather than as a member of the species with a stake in how the arts are portrayed. Of course we find pleasure and enlightenment in contemplating the products of the arts, and not all of it is a pride in sharing the tastes of the beautiful people. But to understand the psychology of the arts that remains when we subtract out the psychology of status, we must leave at the door our terror of being mistaken for the kind of person who prefers Andrew Lloyd Webber to Mozart. We need to begin with folk songs, pulp fiction, and paintings on black velvet, not Mahler, Eliot, and Kandinsky. And that does not mean compensating for our slumming by dressing up the lowly subject matter in highfalutin theory. A semiotic analysis of Peanuts, a psychoanalytic exegesis of Archie Bunker, a deconstruction of Vogue. It means asking a simple question. What is it about the mind that lets people take pleasure in shapes and colors and sounds and jokes and stories and myths? That question might be answerable, whereas questions about art in general are not. Theories of art carry the seeds of their own destruction. In an age when any Joe can buy CDs, paintings, and novels, artists make their careers by finding ways to avoid the hackneyed, to challenge jaded tastes, to differentiate the cognoscenti from the dilettantes, and to flout the current wisdom about what art is. Hence the fruitless attempts over the decades to define art. Any discussion that fails to recognize that dynamic is doomed to sterility. It can never explain why music pleases the ear, because music will be defined to encompass atonal jazz, chromatic compositions, and other intellectual exercises. It will never understand the bawdy laughs and convivial banter that are so important in people's lives, because it will define humor as the arch-wit of an Oscar Wilde. Excellence and the avant-garde are designed for the sophisticated palate, a product of years of immersion in a genre and a familiarity with its conventions and clichés. They rely on one-upmanship and arcane illusions and displays of virtuosity. However fascinating and worthy of our support they are, they tend to obscure the psychology of aesthetics, not to illuminate it. The most common of all follies, wrote H.L. Mencken, is to believe passionately in the palpably not true. It is the chief occupation of mankind. In culture after culture, people believe that the soul lives on after death, that rituals can change the physical world and divine the truth, and that illness and misfortune are caused and alleviated by spirits, ghosts, saints, fairies, angels, demons, cherubim, jinns, devils, and gods. According to polls, more than a quarter of today's Americans believe in witches. Almost half believe in ghosts, half believe in the devil, half believe that the book of Genesis is literally true, 69% believe in angels, 87% believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, and 96% believe in a god or universal spirit. How does religion fit into a mind that one might have thought was designed to reject the palpably not true? The common answer, that people take comfort in the thought of a benevolent shepherd, a universal plan, or an afterlife, is unsatisfying because it only raises the question of why a mind would evolve to find comfort in beliefs it can plainly see are false. A freezing person finds no comfort in believing he is warm. A person face to face with a lion is not put at ease by the conviction that it is a rabbit. What is religion? Like the psychology of the arts, the psychology of religion has been muddied by scholars' attempts to exalt it while understanding it. Religion cannot be equated with our higher spiritual, humane, ethical yearnings, though it sometimes overlaps with them. The Bible contains instructions for genocide, rape, and the destruction of families, and even the Ten Commandments, read in context, prohibit murder, lying, and theft only within the tribe, not against outsiders. Religions have given us stonings, witch burnings, crusades, inquisitions, jihads, fatwas, suicide bombers, abortion clinic gunmen, and mothers who drown their sons so they can be happily reunited in heaven. As Blaise Pascal wrote, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. Religion is not a single topic. What we call religion in the modern West is an alternative culture of laws and customs that survived alongside those of the nation-state because of accidents of European history. Religions, like other cultures, have produced great art, philosophy, and law, but their customs, like those of other cultures, often serve the interests of the people who promulgate them. Ancestor worship must be an appealing idea to people who are about to become ancestors. As one's days dwindle, life begins to shift from an iterative prisoner's dilemma, in which defection can be punished and cooperation rewarded, to a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, in which enforcement is impossible. If you can convince your children that your soul will live on and watch over their affairs, they are less emboldened to defect while you are alive. Food taboos keep members of the tribe from becoming intimate with outsiders. Rites of passage demarcate the people who are entitled to the privileges of social categories, fetus or family member, child or adult, single or married, so as to preempt endless haggling over gray areas. Painful initiations weed out anyone who wants the benefits of membership without being committed to paying the costs. Witches are often mothers-in-law and other inconvenient people. Shamans and priests are wizards of Oz who use special effects, from sleight of hand and ventriloquism to sumptuous temples and cathedrals, to convince others that they are privy to forces of power and wonder. Let's focus on the truly distinctive part of the psychology of religion. The anthropologist Ruth Benedict first pointed out the common thread of religious practice in all cultures. Religion is a technique for success. Ambrose Bierce defined to pray as to ask that the laws of the universe be annulled on behalf of a single petitioner confessedly unworthy. People everywhere beseech gods and spirits for recovery from illness, for success in love or on the battlefield, and for good weather. Religion is a desperate measure that people resort to when the stakes are high and they have exhausted the usual techniques for the causation of success. Medicines, strategies, courtship, and in the case of the weather, nothing. What kind of mind would do something as useless as inventing ghosts and bribing them for good weather? How does that fit into the idea that reasoning comes from a system of modules designed to figure out how the world works? The anthropologists Pascal Boyer and Dan Sperber have shown that it fits rather well. First, non-literate peoples are not psychotic hallucinators who are unable to distinguish fantasy from reality. They know there is a humdrum world of people and objects driven by the usual laws and find the ghosts and spirits of their belief system to be terrifying and fascinating precisely because they violate their own ordinary intuitions about the world. Second, the spirits, talismans, seers, and other sacred entities are never invented out of whole cloth. People take a construct from one of the cognitive modules, an object, person, animal, natural substance, or artifact, and cross out a property or write in a new one, letting the construct keep the rest of its standard-issue traits. A tool or weapon or substance will be granted some extra causal power, but otherwise is expected to behave as it did before. It lives at one place at one time, is unable to pass through solid objects, and so on. A spirit is stipulated to be exempt from one or more of the laws of biology, growing, aging, dying, physics, solidity, visibility, causation by contact, or psychology, thoughts and desires are known only through behavior. But otherwise, the spirit is recognizable as a kind of person or animal. Spirits see and hear, have a memory, have beliefs and desires, act on conditions that they believe will bring about a desired effect, make decisions, and issue threats and bargains. When the elders spread religious beliefs, they never bother to spell out these defaults. No one ever says, if the spirits promise us good weather in exchange for a sacrifice, and they know we want good weather, they predict that we will make the sacrifice. They don't have to, because they know that the minds of the pupils will automatically supply these beliefs from their tacit knowledge of psychology. Believers also avoid working out the strange logical consequences of these piecemeal revisions of ordinary things. They don't pause to wonder why a God who knows our intentions has to listen to our prayers, or how a God can both see into the future and care about how we choose to act. Compared to the mind-bending ideas of modern science, religious beliefs are notable for their lack of imagination. God is a jealous man. Heaven and hell are places. Souls are people who have sprouted wings. That is because religious concepts are human concepts with a few emendations that make them wondrous and a longer list of standard traits that make them sensible to our ordinary ways of knowing. But where do people get the emendations? Even when all else has failed, why would they waste time spinning ideas and practices that are useless, even harmful? Why don't they accept that human knowledge and power have limits and conserve their thoughts for domains in which they can do some good? I have alluded to one possibility. The demand for miracles creates a market that would-be priests compete in, and they can succeed by exploiting people's dependence on experts. I let the dentist drill my teeth and the surgeon cut into my body, even though I cannot possibly verify for myself the assumptions they use to justify those mutilations. That same trust would have made me submit to medical quackery a century ago, and to a witch doctor's charms millennia ago. Of course, witch doctors must have some track record, or they would lose all credibility, and they do blend their hocus-pocus with genuine practical knowledge, such as herbal remedies and prediction of events, for instance the weather, that are more accurate than chance. And beliefs about a world of spirits do not come from nowhere. They are hypotheses intended to explain certain data that stymie our everyday theories. Edward Tyler, an early anthropologist, noted that animistic beliefs are grounded in universal experiences. When people dream, their body stays in bed, but some other part of them is up and about in the world. The soul and the body also part company in the trance brought on by an illness or a hallucinogen. Even when we are awake, we see shadows and reflections in still water that seem to carry the essence of a person without having mass, volume, or continuity in time and space. And in death, the body has lost some invisible force that animates it in life. One theory that brings these facts together is that the soul wanders off when we sleep, lurks in the shadows, looks back at us from the surface of a pond, and leaves the body when we die. Modern science has come up with a better theory of shadows and reflections, but how well does it do at explaining the sentient self that dreams, imagines, and directs the body? Some problems continue to baffle the modern mind. As the philosopher Colin McGinn put it in his summary of them, the head spins in theoretical disarray. No explanatory model suggests itself. Bizarre ontologies loom. There is a feeling of intense confusion, but no clear idea about where the confusion lies. I discussed one of the problems, consciousness in the sense of sentience or subjective experience, not in the sense of information access or self-reflection. How could an event of neural information processing cause the feel of a toothache or the taste of lemon or the color purple? How could I know whether a worm, a robot, a brain slice in a dish, or you are sentient? Is your sensation of red the same as mine, or might it be like my sensation of green? What is it like to be dead? Another imponderable is the self. What or where is the unified center of sentience that comes into and goes out of existence, that changes over time but remains the same entity, and that has a supreme moral worth? Why should the I of 1996 reap the rewards and suffer the punishments earned by the I of 1976? Say I let someone scan a blueprint of my brain into a computer, destroy my body, and reconstitute me in every detail, memories and all. Would I have taken a nap or committed suicide? If two eyes were reconstituted, would I have double the pleasure? How many selves are in the skull of a split-brain patient? What about in the partly fused brains of a pair of Siamese twins? When does a zygote acquire a self? How much of my brain tissue has to die before I die? Free will is another enigma. How can my actions be a choice for which I am responsible if they are completely caused by my genes, my upbringing, and my brain state? Some events are determined, some are random. How can a choice be neither? When I hand my wallet to an armed man who threatens to kill me if I don't, is that a choice? What about if I shoot a child because an armed man threatens to kill me if I don't? If I choose to do something I could have done otherwise, but what does that mean in a single universe unfolding in time according to laws which I pass through only once? I am faced with a momentous decision, and an expert on human behavior with a 99% success rate predicts that I will choose what at this point looks like the worst alternative. Should I continue to agonize, or should I save time and do what's inevitable? A fourth puzzle is meaning. When I talk about planets, I can refer to all planets in the universe, past, present, and future. But how could I right now, here in my house, be standing in some relationship to a planet that will be created in a distant galaxy in 5 million years? If I know what natural number means, my mind has commerce with an infinite set. But I am a finite being who has tasted a tiny sample of the natural numbers. Knowledge is just as perplexing. How could I arrive at the certainty that the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides, everywhere and for all eternity, here in the comfort of my armchair, with not a triangle or tape measure in sight? How do I know that I'm not a brain in a vat, or dreaming, or living a hallucination programmed by an evil neurologist, or that the universe was not created 5 minutes ago complete with fossils, memories, and historical records? If every emerald I have seen so far is green, why should I conclude all emeralds are green, rather than all emeralds are GRU, where GRU means either observed before the year 2020 and green, or not so observed and blue? All the emeralds I have seen are green, but then all the emeralds I've seen are GRU. The two conclusions are equally warranted, but one predicts that the first emerald I see in 2020 will be the color of grass, and the other predicts that it will be the color of the sky. A final conundrum is morality. If I secretly hatchet the unhappy, despised pawnbroker, where is the evil nature of that act registered? What does it mean to say that I shouldn't do it? How did ought emerge from a universe of particles and planets, genes and bodies? If the aim of ethics is to maximize happiness, should we indulge a sicko who gets more pleasure from killing than his victims do from living? If it is to maximize lives, should we publicly execute a framed man if it would deter 1,000 murderers? Or draft a few human guinea pigs for fatal experiments that would save millions? People have thought about these problems for millennia, but have made no progress in solving them. They give us a sense of bewilderment, of intellectual vertigo. McGinn shows how thinkers have cycled among four kinds of solutions over the ages, none satisfactory. Philosophical problems have a feeling of the divine, and the favorite solution in most times and places is mysticism and religion. Consciousness is a divine spark in each of us. The self is the soul, an immaterial ghost that floats above physical events. Souls just exist, or they were created by God. God granted each soul a moral worth and the power of choice. He has stipulated what is good and inscribes every soul's good and evil acts in the book of life and rewards or punishes it after it leaves the body. Knowledge is granted by God to the prophet or the seer, or guaranteed to all of us by God's honesty and omniscience. The solution is explained in the rejoinder to the limerick about why the tree continues to be when there's no one about in the quad. Dear sir, your astonishment's odd. I am always about in the quad, and that's why the tree will continue to be, since observed by yours faithfully, God. The problem with the religious solution was stated by Mencken when he wrote, "Theology is the effort to explain the unknowable in terms of the not worth knowing." For anyone with a persistent intellectual curiosity, religious explanations are not worth knowing because they pile equally baffling enigmas on top of the original ones. What gave God a mind, free will, knowledge, certainty about right and wrong? How does he infuse them into a universe that seems to run just fine according to physical laws? How does he get ghostly souls to interact with hard matter? And most perplexing of all, if the world unfolds according to a wise and merciful plan, why does it contain so much suffering? As the Yiddish expression says, if God lived on earth, people would break his windows. Modern philosophers have tried three other solutions. One is to say that the mysterious entities are an irreducible part of the universe and to leave it at that. The universe, we would conclude, contains space, time, gravity, electromagnetism, nuclear forces, matter, energy, and consciousness, or will, or selves, or ethics, or meaning, or all of them. The answer to our curiosity about why the universe has consciousness is, get over it, it just does. We feel cheated because no insight has been offered, and because we know that the details of consciousness, will, and knowledge are minutely related to the physiology of the brain. The irreducibility theory leaves that a coincidence. A second approach is to deny that there is a problem. We have been misled by fuzzy thinking or by beguiling but empty idioms of language, such as the pronoun I. Statements about consciousness, will, self, and ethics cannot be verified by mathematical proof or empirical test, so they are meaningless. But this answer leaves us incredulous, not enlightened. As Descartes observed, our own consciousness is the most indubitable thing there is. It is a datum to be explained. It cannot be defined out of existence by regulations about what we are allowed to call meaningful, to say nothing of ethical statements such as that slavery and the Holocaust were wrong. A third approach is to domesticate the problem by collapsing it with one we can solve. Consciousness is activity in layer 4 of the cortex, or the contents of short-term memory. Free will is in the anterior cingulate sulcus, or the executive subroutine. Morality is kin selection and reciprocal altruism. Each suggestion of this kind, to the extent that it is correct, does solve one problem, but it just as surely leaves unsolved the main problem. How does activity in layer 4 of the cortex cause my private, pungent, tangy sensation of redness? I can imagine a creature whose layer 4 is active, but who does not have the sensation of red or the sensation of anything. No law of biology rules the creature out. No account of the causal effects of the cingulate sulcus can explain how human choices are not caused at all, hence something we can be held responsible for. Theories of the evolution of the moral sense can explain why we condemn evil acts against ourselves and our kith and kin, but cannot explain the conviction, as unshakable as our grasp of geometry, that some acts are inherently wrong, even if their net effects are neutral or beneficial to our overall well-being. I am partial to a different solution, defended by McGinn and based on speculations by Noam Chomsky, the biologist Gunther Stent, and before them David Hume. Maybe philosophical problems are hard not because they are divine or irreducible or meaningless or workaday science, but because the mind of Homo sapiens lacks the cognitive equipment to solve them. We are organisms, not angels, and our minds are organs, not pipelines to the truth. Our minds evolved by natural selection to solve problems that were life and death matters to our ancestors, not to commune with correctness or to answer any question we are capable of asking. We cannot hold 10,000 words in short-term memory. We cannot see ultraviolet light. We cannot mentally rotate an object in the fourth dimension. And perhaps we cannot solve conundrums like free will and sentience. We can well imagine creatures with fewer cognitive faculties than we have. Dogs, to whom our language sounds like blah, 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 ginger, blah, blah. Rats that cannot learn a maze with food in the prime numbered arms. Autistics who cannot conceive of other minds. Children who cannot understand what the fuss around sex is about. Neurological patients who see every detail in a face except whose it is. Stereo-blind people who can understand a stereogram as a problem in geometry but cannot see it pop out in depth. If stereo-blind people did not know better, they might call 3D vision a miracle or claim that it just is and needs no explanation or write it off as some kind of trick. So why should there not be creatures with more cognitive faculties than we have, or with different ones? They might readily grasp how free will and consciousness emerge from a brain and how meaning and morality fit into the universe, and would be amused by the religious and philosophical headstands we do to make up for our blankness when facing these problems. They could try to explain the solutions to us, but we would not understand the explanations. The hypothesis is almost perversely unprovable, though it could be disproved if anyone ever solved the age-old puzzles of philosophy. And there are indirect reasons to suspect it is true. One is that the species' best minds have flung themselves at the puzzles for millennia but have made no progress in solving them. Another is that they have a different character from even the most challenging problems of science. Problems such as how a child learns language or how a fertilized egg becomes an organism are horrendous in practice and may never be solved completely. but if they aren't, it will be for mundane practical reasons. The causal processes are too intertwined or chaotic, the phenomena are too messy to capture and dissect in the lab, the math is beyond the capacity of foreseeable computers. But scientists can imagine the kinds of theories that might be solutions, right or wrong, feasible to test or not. Sentience and will are different. Far from being too complicated, they are maddeningly simple. Consciousness and choice inhere in a special dimension or coloring that is somehow pasted onto neural events without meshing with their causal machinery. The challenge is not to discover the correct explanation of how that happens, but to imagine a theory that could explain how it happens, a theory that would place the phenomenon as an effect of some cause, any cause. It is easy to draw extravagant and unwarranted conclusions from the suggestion that our minds lack the equipment to solve the major problems of philosophy. It does not say that there is some paradox of self-reference or infinite regress in a mind's trying to understand itself. Psychologists and neuroscientists don't study their own minds, they study someone else's. Nor does it imply some principled limitation on the possibility of knowledge by any knower, like the uncertainty principle or Gödel's theorem. It is an observation about one organ of one species, equivalent to observing that cats are colorblind or that monkeys cannot learn long division. It does not justify religious or mythical beliefs, but explains why they are futile. Philosophers would not be out of a job because they clarify these problems, chip off chunks that can be solved, and solve them or hand them over to science to solve. The hypothesis does not imply that we have sighted the end of science or bumped into a barrier on how much we can ever learn about how the mind works. The computational aspect of consciousness, what information is available to which processes, the neurological aspect, what in the brain correlates with consciousness, and the evolutionary aspect, when and why did the neurocomputational aspects emerge, are perfectly tractable, and I see no reason why we should not have decades of progress and eventually a complete understanding. Even if we never solve residual brain teasers like whether your red is the same as my red or what it is like to be a bat. In mathematics, one says that the integers are closed under addition. Adding two integers produces another integer. It can never produce a fraction. But that does not mean that the set of integers is finite. Humanly thinkable thoughts are closed under the workings of our cognitive faculties and may never embrace the solutions to the mysteries of philosophy, but the set of thinkable thoughts may be infinite nonetheless. Is cognitive closure a pessimistic conclusion? Not at all. I find it exhilarating, a sign of great progress in our understanding of the mind. And it is my last opportunity to pursue the goal of this book, to get you to step outside your own mind for a moment and see your thoughts and feelings as magnificent contrivances of the natural world, rather than as the only way that things could be. First, if the mind is a system of organs designed by natural selection, why should we ever have expected it to comprehend all mysteries, to grasp all truths? We should be thankful that the problems of science are close enough in structure to the problems of our foraging ancestors that we have made the progress that we have. If there were nothing we were bad at understanding, we would have to question the scientific worldview that sees the mind as a product of nature. Cognitive closure should be true if we know what we are talking about. Still, one might have thought that the hypothesis was merely a daydream, a logical possibility that could go no further than late-night dorm room bull sessions. McGinn's attempt to identify the humanly unsolvable problems is an advance. Even better, we can glimpse why certain problems are beyond our ken. A recurring theme of this book is that the mind owes its power to its syntactic, compositional, combinatorial abilities. Our complicated ideas are built out of simpler ones, and the meaning of the whole is determined by the meanings of the parts and the meanings of the relations that connect them. Part of a whole, example of a category, thing at a place, actor exerting force, cause of an effect, mind holding a belief. These logical and law-like connections provide the meanings of sentences in everyday speech and, through analogies and metaphors, lend their structures to the esoteric contents of science and mathematics, where they are assembled into bigger and bigger theoretical edifices. We grasp matter as molecules, atoms, and quarks, life as DNA, genes, and a tree of organisms, change as position, momentum, and force, mathematics as symbols and operations. All are assemblies of elements composed according to laws, in which the properties of the whole are predictable from the properties of the parts and the way they are combined. Even when scientists grapple with seamless continua and dynamical processes, they couch their theories in words, equations, and computer simulations, combinatorial media that mesh with the workings of the mind. We are lucky that parts of the world behave as lawful interactions among simpler elements. But there is something peculiarly holistic and everywhere at once and nowhere at all and all at the same time about the problems of philosophy. Sentience is not a combination of brain events or computational states. How a red-sensitive neuron gives rise to the subjective feel of redness is not a whit less mysterious than how the whole brain gives rise to the entire stream of consciousness. The eye is not a combination of body parts or brain states or bits of information, but a unity of selfness over time, a single locus that is nowhere in particular. Free will is not a causal chain of events and states by definition, although the combinatorial aspect of meaning has been worked out, how words or ideas combine into the meanings of sentences or propositions, the core of meaning, the simple act of referring to something, remains a puzzle, because it stands strangely apart from any causal connection between the thing referred to and the person referring. Knowledge, too, throws up the paradox that knowers are acquainted with things that have never impinged upon them. Our thoroughgoing perplexity about the enigmas of consciousness, self, will, and knowledge may come from a mismatch between the very nature of these problems and the computational apparatus that natural selection has fitted us with. If these conjectures are correct, our psyche would present us with the ultimate tease. The most undeniable thing there is, our own awareness, would be forever beyond our conceptual grasp. But if our minds are part of nature, that is to be expected, even welcomed. The natural world evokes our awe by the specialized designs of its creatures and their parts. We don't poke fun at the eagle for its clumsiness on the ground or fret that the eye is not very good at hearing, because we know that a design can excel at one challenge only by compromising at others. Our bafflement at the mysteries of the ages may have been the price we paid for a combinatorial mind that opened up a world of words and sentences, of theories and equations, of poems and melodies, of jokes and stories, the very things that make a mind worth having. This is Grover Gardner for Audio Scholar. Thank you for listening.